Their unique experiences of trauma turned into empowerment. Again, that's the second annual International Self-Care Day celebration on Tuesday, July 24th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Pela on the third floor of the Lloyd Center Mall in Northeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this July 23rd Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local, independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities are available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com. Well, this morning on The Old Mole, we're going to take a deep look at education. Portland Rising and Portland Association of Teachers is bringing Nicole McCormick to Portland to talk about the West Virginia strike and lessons learned. McCormick was a leader and organizer in the West Virginia strike, and she talks with Bill Resnick about her upcoming visit. Bill returns then to talk with Elizabeth Teal about the Janus decision in which the conservative Supreme Court joined in union busting by trying to destroy their financial base. What teachers are doing about it, we'll hear about that from Elizabeth Teal, who currently is the Vice President of Portland Association of Teachers. I will talk with Jan Hawken about the article, Power Causes Brain Damage, How Leaders Lose Mental Capacities, Most Notably for Reading Other People, that were essential to their rise. This is an article written by Jerry Usom from the Atlantic Monthly, is kind of making the rounds, and has a particular promise about trying to explain what might be going on with some of our most powerful leaders. We'll talk about that article. And Jan Hawken will return to talk with Yuvia Magali Morello and Tanya Goldman, members of the Oregon Vending Community, about native vending practices and organizing. They'll discuss the work of vending and their own work in organizing vendors as a community. We'll hear all of that this morning on The Old Mole. I am Denise Morris for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting KBOO and programs like The Old Mole. Now we'll turn to Bill Resnick and Nicole McCormick.
Hi, Nicole McCormick. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Nicole McCormick is a middle school teacher, a leader in the statewide West Virginia teachers strike. She's coming to Portland. In fact, tonight she'll be speaking at the Portland Association of Teachers office, 345 Northeast 8th Avenue. The topic is Inside the West Virginia Teachers Strike. Nicole, the strike in West Virginia, it was really an amazing, shocking event, actually, for people interested in labor politics and the teachers' unions. It was watched by teachers really around the country. And, of course, the question was, how did they do it? They forced a Republican legislature, solidly Republican legislature, and they basically surrendered on all sorts of important issues. So give us a brief sense of how you did it. What was at stake?
Sure. At first, it was shocking to me, too. It was very unexpected. I've been an active participant in our union. I've been a dues-paying member for my entire teaching career, which is about 9 years. But I've been in leadership positions and executive committees and building reps and co-presidents, and I'm our current elected president for this upcoming school year. And I saw the same 15 faces at every meeting. And I had no expectation of anything as wild and as exciting as the teacher strike, and really more, and I guess correct would be the educator strike, because if it hadn't been for our, what we call our service professionals, cooks, custodians, all of those folks that make sure everything works properly, we may not have been as successful. But really, it was rank and file, ground up led, which I think is that we never forget that we are the union bosses and that we are the ones that decide what kind of changes we want to see. So to have that happen at a state level was and is amazing. And I still just can't believe we did it.
And every county very quickly rose up. What was the background for this eruption of struggle from what were pretty quiescent teachers?
Right. I mean, you don't necessarily think of teachers as revolutionaries or someone that's going to stand up and actually fight. It seems that we more often are kind of kicked to the side and we take it. But, I mean, I think that we do need to take into consideration the teacher strike of 1990. Even though that was quite some time ago, a lot of teachers that were just beginning then are now retiring. And so we had their history, their experience to kind of push us through. Also just labor history in West Virginia. You know, you learn that as a child, Blair Mountain and Matewan and all of those struggles and people taking up arms to fight for their lives and that of their children. But really it was, I think, desperation was the biggest factor. People, they realized that they could not afford to stay. That
I mean, to afford to stay in the state because wages were so low and higher in other places.
Right. You can go to any neighboring state and make at least a couple $1,000s more. Now, I mean, I know that you have to take into account the cost of living, but even with that, you still will make more money, even with, you know, increased living expenditures. But the biggest issue was we had taken a pay cut the last 3 years because our health care costs had continually risen, and our salary is stagnant, and these supposed yearly increases because of your time served in the public school system, it wasn't enough. And we were looking down the barrel of even more drastic cost increases to our state health care. So it was a kind of a do or die situation.
Nicole, you'll be talking about that in a lot more detail at the meeting tonight at 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the Portland Association of Teachers Hall, which is on Northeast 8th Street, four blocks north of Burnside. Nicole, let's talk about a few things that might not touch on tomorrow night. Your strike was so important, and your strike was unusual in that in West Virginia, the teachers struck not only for themselves or for other school personnel, but for all other state employees. Tell us about how you made that decision.
Sure. Whenever that, two of my friends, Jay and Emily, created our secret Facebook page, which was really the platform that we communicated on, it actually started out as West Virginia Public Teachers United. And that was in probably August or September of 2017, and there was about 30 people on there, I think. Whenever that PEIA, which is the Public Employees Insurance Agency, which covers all state workers, unless that your spouse has access to a different health care plan, that is your health insurance. The end. There is no other choice. So we quickly realized whenever the PEIA put out their new plan for how they were going to get their money to cover our health costs, and that would probably be in October of 2017, that we needed more people to be involved in this fight, because the teachers and the school personnel were in the minority. There were fewer of us than the rest of the West Virginians that were on this. So we need to really be united. And this was something that concerned all of us. And if we wanted to have any chance in really making effective change, that we had to involve other people. So we changed the name to West Virginia Public Employees United, and we went from 30 people in September to a little over 24,000 people now currently. And even though that may not sound like many people, there are only 1.8 million people in the entire state of West Virginia, and there are only 20,000 teachers in the entire state. So you know, we're very proud of how many people are active participants and still are participating in the conversation on how we are going to hopefully permanently fix our healthcare system or get it to a point to where that it can sustain itself and we can stay in West Virginia and serve the public, the people, the children of West Virginia.
One final issue, Nicole McCormick, one of the leaders of the West Virginia strike, started apparently with a secret Facebook page that teachers went to in droves, and suddenly it erupted. Tell us about Mercer County. It's a poor county. It's in southeast West Virginia. I looked at the figures. It's older. It's 90% white, 6% black, and then there are some others. Less than 1% Hispanic. A very old white county. 75% of voters were Trump voters. 20% went to Hillary. This is a, looks like a conservative group. And yet, all of those people who voted for Trump, they were also supporting you, is my sense. How did that happen?
Well, I think kind of a multifold. You mentioned the secret Facebook group. And myself and my husband, who is also a teacher, we helped by moderating the page with a slew of other people that worked in the education system. With those connections, with those conversations that were had online and those ideas that came from other counties, we were able to also use those ideas in our county. We had in-person conversations. We connected with community members, whether those be parents or churches, whenever that we were trying to make sure that our children had meals that they could eat while we were potentially going to be out. We had informational pickets. We had a town hall where we invited local elected officials, parents, community members in general to listen to what they had to say, to what we had to say, to see if we could come up to some kind of ideas on how to fix the issues. But I think that anyone that is a public servant, you have a built-in connection with the people that you serve. Most of us, whenever that we choose the job that we do, we know we're not going to be wealthy in any sense of the word, but we also want to make a difference in our community. We want to lift up people. And with that means that a lot of times you have to personally sacrifice. You sacrifice your time, you sacrifice your money, your energy, sometimes your health. And I feel like that people notice that, whether they say it a lot or not, they do. So when we were on the picket line, you know, we had parent-teacher organizations bringing us food and ponchos and hand warmers and coffee, and that was because that we served their children. And that's not unique to West Virginia.
It happened in Portland, actually, a couple of years ago, a very interesting strike. I'm sure you're going to hear about it, Nicole McCormick. In fact, this evening, and on Monday evening at 7, Nicole's going to be speaking at the Portland Association of Teachers Hall at 345 Northeast 8th. Nicole, thanks so much for talking to us.
You're welcome. I'm really looking forward to the opportunity to be there.
Yes, it'll be really good. Thank you.
I gave you all I had to give, my love, my time, I couldn't give the life I live. That can't be right, I never thought that this could be. For you and me, the scenes of fate I couldn't see, the song I'd never see.
That is Loyalty, Alice Smith, a great song and a decent tribute to our teachers, I think. We're going to hear more about what's going on with teachers in Portland coming up next, but let me let you know what's coming down the road. I'll be talking with Jan Hocken about the article Power Causes Brain Damage. We'll look into the science behind powerful people and their very strange and bad behavior. Also, Jan will be talking with Yuvia Magali Morello and Tanya Golden about native vending practices and organizing. That'll all be coming up later in the program. Now we have Bill Resnick and Elizabeth Teal talking about the Janus decision and what Portland public school teachers are up to these days.
Well, thank you, Denise. Elizabeth Teal, welcome to KABU.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Elizabeth Teal taught English and social studies at Portland Public School, middle and high schools for how many? 14 years. Elizabeth is also a union activist on the legislative committee and the PAC, was very active in challenging high-stakes testing, and is now the vice president of the union with the Portland Association of Teachers. So, Elizabeth, 4 years ago, you were the head organizer for the PAT at Madison High School. There's a head organizer in every school, I gather, is the
way
it works.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were many sort of shop stewards, too. You had a 1 in 10 program.
Yep.
You really organized for that strike. The teachers were ready, and it paid off. In its wisdom, the board at the time, with a few conservative people on it, in its wisdom, they hired a very well-known, very aggressive union-busting law firm to run the negotiation. And the union busters began by offering a completely unacceptable contract with a list of 44 takebacks. Was it 44 or 42?
I don't remember, but that's the neighborhood. Yeah.
Yes, completely unacceptable and an insult actually to teachers. Mm-hmm. But they thought they could just come in with that, and then you'd have to compromise if they put enough pressure on you, was the idea, I guess. Well, we only have to give back 10 things then,
right,
of the 48, and then they called that a victory, right? Well, the PAT decided not to go along with that system. They instead offered their contract proposal, which was as radical as the contract proposal by the union busters, but of course was very, very, very different. And it was centered around the idea of not wages and benefits so much, although they had to be preserved, but it really centered around how do we really improve the Portland schools? And then that became the rallying cry for the union, mm-hmm, in all of the media, and you did a great job with media as well. I remember Gwen Sullivan being on the air all the time,
mm-hmm,
who was the then president of the union, around the idea we want to bring to Portland the schools that Portland students deserve. And here is our plan for the schools, which included things like smaller class sizes, less administrators. What were some of the other contract proposals that were so appealing to people and that you fought for at that time, Elizabeth?
Yeah, well, part of our vision for the schools Portland students deserve was and still is full wraparound services for students to meet their needs, including counselors and social workers and academic supports, electives, including art and music and many other things available to all students, equity across the district. Right now, schools don't offer the same things in every neighborhood, and some students have access to a lot more than other students in their neighborhood schools. But we dug into a process that took us several years to envision what it is that we believe our public schools should and can be, and how can we use our contract to fight for those things and bringing us closer to that vision and eventually realizing it.
Yeah, and we'll get back to it. You really organized parents and talked to students. You did not organize students. When they came to you, however, you were perfectly free to talk about, mm-hmm, what the issues were. It was really successful. We'll talk about that later in the interview, how that's going to have to happen again in some ways, and organizing the teachers. Back, though, to the negotiations 4 years ago, they got very heated. The lawyers really dug in they thought that they could break you, that ultimately these teachers are not going to be able to organize themselves and organize the community, and we can get the community on our side because we can break those teachers and their too high salaries, even though, of course, Portland salaries are below most of the suburbs now. Mm-hmm. And you really weren't pushing for parity, although the difference was not that great. So in any event, the Union Busters thought, we'll just put them to the test. And, of course, finally, a day before the strike, the school board realized that this strike was popular in the city, that the parents were supporting the teachers, that the strike would hold, that you had made provision for parents to have daycare for their younger children in lieu of schools. You made provisions with the churches and other organizations. You were serving the free lunch program, which is the major meal for a lot of kids in Portland, as it is around the United States, for the bottom 50% of people. In the richest country in the world, the schools are the major feeding program for children. In any event, you made all those provisions so that the strike really didn't hurt people. The school board recognized that their Union Busters had miscalculated completely. The teachers were, and they gave up, basically. The Union Busting lawyers, who had a long contract, so they had to be paid, but they were taken off of the negotiation beat. The school board negotiated directly with the teachers, and you won almost pretty much many of your most important provisions survived. It was an amazing victory. And it happened, you know, at PSU, too, the same firm. Ultimately, yeah. The administration got rid of them, too, because the PSU teachers really organized so successfully. It was an amazing period, actually, in Portland. Tell us about that, the contract that you won and the way you won it.
Well, I think that the whole process is exactly it's a great example of why we need unions and why we need strong unions. Teachers were not willing to give up the things that help us to do our jobs for kids better. That includes protecting our workload, because workload means how many kids we serve, how many classes we teach, so that we can do those things well, not just do more things with less time and less energy. Teachers come into this profession because they want to be excellent teachers. They want to make a difference in students' lives. And our contract is one of the ways that we can preserve our ability to do the job that we came into this profession to do. And so one of the big things the district wanted to take away was language we have protecting our workload. And we were able to preserve it. And in our most recent, we actually just negotiated a new contract this spring. It took us about 2 years of negotiation. It was excruciating to get there. And again, the district came with the intention of taking away our workload protection language.
Yeah, workload, though, it has a couple of meanings, and I think mm-hmm. we have to be more careful about
yeah.
it. You're working during the school year and then in the summer, many teachers, because they have to make ends meet, they work 12-hour days, it seems to me. The workload on the teacher would remain the same, but school board well knows is why parents are, the workload would remain the same. The number of students, however, is the way they talk about workload, right? So they want you to serve 200 students rather than 140.
Right.
And that's what you meant. We want 140 students rather than 200.
Well, that's one of the big things. If you think about being an English teacher, as I am, if you have 140 students and you assign an essay and then you bring it home that weekend to grade it because you don't have time to do it during the school day, that's 140 essays times 10 minutes. And if you do the math, that's an awful big chunk of your weekend. If you have 200 students,
It's impossible to do a good, decent job.
Exactly.
And then you start assigning multiple choice tests.
Well, that's...
How do you protect yourself if you cannot really assign, get kids to really think?
Mm-hmm.
Then you sort of grade them with these things that don't challenge them in the proper way and that don't really give you information and that create kids who than prepare for multiple choice tests rather than thinking how to think.
Right. So we were really thinking about it in terms of making the day for students a better day. We don't want to just cram more in. We don't want to cram more students into classrooms. We don't want to cram more shallow content in. We want deep relationships with kids, deep exploration of content, and we know that's what a good education is. And if you look at when people with means send their children to private schools, they know what a good education is, and it is not large class sizes and cramming test questions.
Can you imagine a elite private school, or even the very well-funded public schools in the suburbs around the country, having 35 kids in a class? The parents would rebel. No one would send their kids there. Right now, in the elite private schools, it's like 10 and 12 in the class. Right. They get all kinds of attention. They get support. And it's these same parents, of course, the hedge funders and the rest of them, the very, very rich, who send their kids to these extraordinarily good schools, actually. Who think that somehow for the other people, 40 people in a class is fine.
Right.
Cramming stuff down their throat and then asking them and then forcing them to take multiple choice tests, that's all fine for them. They seem to think that that's what the little people need. It's a terrible sort of irony, but it's also outrageous and ugly. It certainly
belies the fact that that's not based on a real desire to give kids the education they deserve. We believe that every student deserves to be known and valued for who they are and given the resources that they need, and not standardized to the point that if you don't fit the mold, you don't get to be valued.
Right. And for a lot of kids, they really do need a lot of support and attention.
Absolutely.
And especially middle schoolers and teenagers going through all kinds of troubles with identity and disappointments that they inevitably experience, it seems to me. And they look to their teachers. Often parents, it's difficult often in families. That's another story. But they do look for teachers. A supportive teacher can be an enormously important person in a student's life.
Absolutely.
The teacher, when you have 200 or 300 students, many of them begging and needing attention, it must be really, for teachers, it must be horribly difficult to...
Well, it is. And to meet those needs, those social, emotional needs that you're talking about, teachers create communities in their classroom, and they make time for kids to get to know each other and for the teacher to get to know them and to figure out ways to solve problems. It's one of the most amazing things about public schools is that there are these communities that would not form otherwise. I know I value so much I have two kids of my own. They go to Vernon Elementary here in Portland Public, and the opportunities they have to struggle and with all of the things we struggle with as people in communities, and then learn from their teachers how to negotiate those difficult situations and support each other and make your community stronger for it. Those things are just, they become near impossible to do when you are dealing with, say, 30 12-year-olds crammed into a small, hot room with no time to really listen to every individual voice.
Yeah. And the fact is, the contract makes a difference.
It does.
The contract structures all of the way that the teacher... If you don't have a decent contract, in fact, you wind up not being able to teach. Elizabeth Thiel, let me reintroduce you. You're a longtime teacher in Portland, obviously a wonderful teacher. You have another contract up and you're negotiating it now. It's become much more complicated now with the Janus decision, but of course you had a long time to prepare for Janus. It was obvious the conservative Supreme Court would upend all previous precedent and decide that they wanted to destroy unions. public unions in particular. Tell us about how you're, we only have another 4 minutes or so. Tell us about how you're preparing for Janus. And it's really a task of organizing teachers is the first step.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just to clarify, we just negotiated the contract. We are not currently negotiating, but we will be back to the table sometime in the next year because it expires in June.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Two minutes.
So the Janus decision obviously is a huge attack on unions. In order to deal with it, we're just going back to the way that unions were formed. It's about individuals reaching out to each other as a union, as people who support each other. A union is a community. And we have been putting a lot of effort for a long time, knowing Janus is coming, into making sure we are personally connecting with every one of our members through our rep structures. Every school elects their own union reps. And making sure that those reps are supported and reaching out to every person in their school and working on the problems that we face as educators in order to improve our schools and make sure it's a profession that, I mean, I think about younger teachers. I've been a teacher for 14 years and it's become a lot harder to be a teacher in that time. One of my goals is to make sure that teachers starting now want to stay in the profession for the next 25-30 years, that it's a sustainable profession so that they can gain the skills that you develop over time in really becoming a master teacher and putting those to work for our community. And we have to support teachers in order to keep them.
Yeah, and one thing I'd maybe mention that my sense is the PAT not only goes to teachers, it tries to it listens to teachers, it activates teachers, it helps people develop their skills, but also understand what's happening in the schools and then ask them, they become active players in decision making.
Absolutely.
That seems to me central.
Yeah, we are a democratic organization and it is our structure and our goal to make sure that, I mean, every teacher is a union member and is part of the process and everything we do is based on what teachers are asking for and what teachers need. And I should, it's not just teachers. We're counselors and media specialists and school psychologists, but we're educators in schools. And what educators need is what PAT acts on.
Elizabeth Teal, Vice President of the Portland Association of Teachers, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
That is the fifth dimension with Save the Country. My mother actually turned me on to the fifth dimension when I was quite a little child. So I have a special place in my heart for that song. And
shout out to Mom there.
Yeah, shout out to Mom. Hi, Mom. Later in the program, Jan, who's with me now, will be talking with Yuvia Magali Morello and Tanya Golden about Oregon vending community and the Native vending practices and organizing that's going on. We'll have that to conclude today's program. But this morning, I had a one of those moments in life where I saw an article pass my vision and I said, I've got to talk about this with Jan. So we're going to talk.
The KABU resonant psychologist.
Yeah, exactly. Resonant psychologist. And we always pick the movies that have the most psychological depth as well to review. So Jan, I'll have you as my expert today, but let me just start with a little bit on this article we're going to talk about. And I'll start with a quote here. If power were a prescription drug, it would come with a long list of known side effects. It can intoxicate. It can corrupt. It can even make Henry Kissinger believe that he's sexually magnetic. But can it cause brain damage? So this is the lead question in this new article in the Atlantic Monthly for the July-August edition. Power causes brain damage. How leaders lose mental capacities, and most notably, reading other people. That the subtitle's a little confusing. I'm going to leave that for now. But the article's written by Jerry Usom, who covers business and economics for publications like the New York Times and Fortune magazine. The article explores the science behind bad behavior of powerful people and is kind of making the rounds, as I said, on social media with the promise of speaking to the fears and anxieties of having powerful and seemingly deranged CEOs and presidents run the country. So, and the promise is a promise. We'll see where that promise leads. But really, the full article is title alludes to this notion that there's a deficit that's created through.
And if it's found, power. And if it's in the brain, it must be real.
It must be real.
Reading this article remind me of those 1980s. PSAs, this is your fried eggs. This is your brain on drugs.
Exactly.
And this is we should have fried eggs. This is your brain on a power trip.
On a power trip. And, you know, it's interesting stuff. You know, really, the article goes over the research on the ways that power impacts the brain and the resulting behavior and the diminished capacity, particularly for empathy, which I know you can speak to. And essentially, power impoverishes people. But to what ends might that scientific study of power and the brain lead? We'll try to cover as much of this as possible.
Well, the first part of this article brings in neuroscience, and it's become a habit of journalists to cite neuroscientists to establish that something's real. So this mirror neurons claim, which is it has its own kind of fictionalized mythology attached to it. I mean, there's something there, but I think this idea that if you can see it on an MRI or neuroscientists can establish some correlation with something going on in the brain, it makes it more real in a scientific sense. And, you know, it's there is an interesting social science literature on the impoverishing effects of power for a very long time. But I think often what's missing is the long literature of oppressed people who have diagnosed their oppressors and the way in which oppressed people suffer depression and anxiety and have to contain their anger in unhealthy ways, but that the oppressed are diminished and impoverished and in many ways that they disavow. I think the issue is the disavowal and the denial of the pathologies of power. Franz Fanon wrote quite a bit about the psychoexistential complexes of the oppressed. Albert Memmi in a classic book from the 50s that's still very timely, The Colonizer and the Colonized, talks about different pathologies of the colonizers and their identification with the colony. And I think feminists and black studies, Native, Indian, Latino, Latina studies in the 1970s really rejected what had been a kind of liberal social science perspective that oppressed people suffer deficits and we have to provide measures for them to catch up and to score higher on the measures in place for self-development or self-realization. And many argued that, you know, it's that it's the oppressor often that suffers the bundle of deficits, that lacks capacity, and that there was a whole set of studies that unfolded that showed that women were better. Initially, it was thought argue that women are better at reading nonverbal cues, develop greater social intelligence, reading facial cues, body language. But then another wave of studies concluded that it was oppressed people who are better at reading subtle social clues, that the oppressed don't have to. And I think this new wave of revived by the anxiety over Trump, this new wave of interest in pinning a diagnosis on him and interest in what the same article calls the hubris syndrome, is in some ways misses the point of these more relational approaches. Mimi talked about the colonizer and the colonized, the oppressed and the oppressor, that there are dynamics that are bad for people who are oppressed and the oppressor in societies based on racism and class oppression and sexism.
Right, and you know, one of the things that drew me to the article that I think really believed would be there or not be there, again, we're talking about deficits. So one of the big deficits is, in the interest of studying powerful people of a particular ilk, presidents, prime ministers, CEOs, we don't have a real broad sense of what kind of power we're actually talking about, but also, or the range of power.
Some of which are effective forms of power, and some of which hold more or less of the consequences of people's lives.
Right.
Power in a ball game is not the same as, in general, as power over people's livelihoods or controlling their environment.
Right. Yeah, we're not talking about chicks dig the long ball here. You know, it's not a game. It's not a game. It's very consequential. And so the context of that is capitalism. So for a writer who I've never met, but I will say, as if his interest is in economics and corporate power, et cetera, that's one place where power is exhibited to the detriment of really everyone. And you talk about
controlling the conditions of people's lives.
Yeah, understanding disorders as not an individual experience, the way that I think this science sort of leads to, because it's focal on the brain, but that there's a social component, and that there's a reciprocal or a dynamic between social structures, communities, etc., where people are damaged by this stuff.
Yeah, and I think most of the disorders that are advanced as ways of diagnosing someone like Donald Trump still locate pathology within the head of the individual as a kind of deficit model, and fail to attend to the relational dynamics of even everyday mental disorders, that often there's a context, there are consequences that are either there or not there for people in power. Harvey Weinstein, for example, had a host of enablers and people who benefit from this behavior or look the other way, so that I think the pathology that this sets the center of this hubris model is not having checks on power. And I think even among our own, progressive leaders, if you're the biggest thing in the room and you get this mirroring back without being accountable to people and having consequences, that there's a social pathology of power that is, I think, the more important dynamic. Maybe we can return to that later time. I'll share my favorite. If you're going to pick a diagnosis from the DSM, I have one that I think is more apt than narcissistic personality disorder, the usual one, or antisocial personality disorder. There is a relational dynamic going on with Trump and the public, and I think it's important for us to confront how much he inhabits people's psyches, how much focus there is on him versus his being a product of this culture and conservatives. He's not just an anomaly, a pathological person coming out of nowhere. He's a product of this society and the political forces in this society.
Yeah, that's really the important note, I think, to end on, right?
Yeah.
Jan Hocken, Denise Morris, we've been talking about the article in the Atlantic Monthly by Jerry Usom, Power Causes Brain Damage. We'll link it on our website. Thanks, Jan.
Thanks.
Yoko Ono with Woman Power from the way back, 1973. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That's 90.7 FM. You're listening this morning to us. Thank you for joining us again. We are every Monday morning on KBOO, so you can come back next week, hear some more. You can catch us on the web as well at the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO.FM. We're going to conclude today's show with Jan Hocken talking with Yuvia Magali Morello and Tanya Golden about Oregon vending community, native vending practices and organizing. Take it away.
Welcome to KBOO, Yuvia and Tanya.
Thank you.
Well, you're both part of and have been involved in organizing the Native American Community and Artist Village space at last Thursday in Alberta. And at Alberta Space and on Alberta Street. That'll be this coming Thursday, and we'll talk a bit about that so people can know where to find you this Thursday. But let's start with vending practices. And of course, there are all kinds of vendors. It's a big, big category. But your work involves vending practices within Native communities and minority communities where you don't have stable retail space, mm-hmm. but bring a lot of what you make and produce to community and local markets, and have to navigate these spaces that are much more insecure, and yet also involve communities coming together to as vendors. So, Tanya, do you want to start? What is your vending practice, and what is your work? And then we can talk about the vending community.
I make herbal medicine, and I started with food stamps, making raw chocolate truffles, and was able to raise enough money from that to buy the containers for salves and tinctures. And this will lead into another project. But as it is, I'm able to bring the medicines from my training as an herbalist to the community, which for me is a really good thing. It feels good being able to help people out. And I was raised by, my mom was a vendor also. She did gourmet preserves. We had a farm raising peaches outside of Hillsboro, north of Hillsboro. So it was something I was brought up in.
Mm-hmm. Yuvia, what do you produce? What do you make that then you sell as a vendor?
Sure. My small business is named Indigenous Come Up, and I work with young adults who have survived DHS family separation, also known as youth that have aged out of the foster care system. And what we do is we make art, crafts, and jewelry. And a lot of the business is about us making these things together and creating community for these youth that are often you know, have support through DHS, and then that just everything ends at the age of 21.
So there's a social service and support aspect.
Absolutely. We call it community sufficiency. So we're trying to create a mentor and just a community, you know, so youth have people to look at, to talk to. But right now we make arts, crafts, jewelry, and we sell them. We've only been officially a business since April, and we sell at local powwows and markets. So this venture with the Last Thursday Alberta is really exciting to us to have. As you say, we don't have a lot of permanency right now. We can't tell you where we're going to be next year. But this is something that we hope will be a permanent space for years to come for our community. So this is really exciting. And as Tanya mentioned, I too grew up in the Oregon Native community. My mother was a jewelry vendor. And so for me too, vending is kind of in my blood and it's part of who I am. And I actually wanted to share that opportunity with other youth because it gave me a lot of confidence to be able to try new things, you know, because I was out there as a young person. I would give other vendors a break for their bathroom and be paid for that. So, you know, you get really innovative with what you have in these spaces. So, yeah.
And that's important to acknowledge both the creativity and the resourcefulness mm-hmm. that comes out of these insecure situations and having to work together to survive, but also not to romanticize that, but to say it is important to claim more space and more resources. Tanya, can you talk some about how that network and mutual support side of being a vending mm-hmm. community?
So a couple winters ago, a group of us vendors got together and called ourselves Native Vendors United. We started creating pop-up marketplaces. We had one on Mississippi Ave during the winter, snowstorms, no heat in the building. We did one in Northwest at the community center up there. And through this, every single one of us that's a member of the group has been trying to find space where we can do more pop-up markets. And this includes people speaking to the different issues that our Native community is facing, because we are one of the most underserved communities in our whole country. And I believe Portland has the highest percentage of Natives per capita.
Underserved, just in terms of access to markets and food and other goods.
Everything. Poverty. Sorry. Our poverty mm-hmm. levels are far greater than other demographics.
And so that is part of then the vending community, depending on being able to sell what you have, but also who people you serve as vendors as well.
Right. It gives us some sort of independence too. It allows us to be able to do things that have been traditional for us and bring that to the greater community. It's an education. It's a way to bridge that gap and help people understand each other's cultures better. When we've spoke about water, had people speaking about water or the different plants, people would come and sit and we'd share that experience together. And it was really good for the whole community. We have the drum come out too, and a couple folks in the community, Carrie Young, she plays a wonderful flute and she'll come out and play. So it's bringing a whole part of us and sharing that with the rest of the folks, allowing us to make some sort of an income. We are searching for a permanent to semi-permanent space that would host us for the vendors to rotate in and out as needed and share the workload of having to take care of that space. But that's a ways out. We have to think about bills and insurance and blah, 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 which is a lot more than moving our canopy.
Many, many people associate the pop-up markets with the Saturday market.
Mm-hmm.
And which is also, of course, a place where tourists go and Can you say something about your experience with pop-up markets or community markets that might depart from what people see at the Saturday market? You do want to comment on that?
Sure. My business has been a part of a new venture here in Portland called the My People's Market, and that has been just a really thrilling thing, not only for my business, but for me personally as a vendor and having grown up actually at the Portland Saturday Market and the Eugene Saturday Market. My mom used to wake us up at like 5 a.m. from Eugene, and we'd travel up here every weekend and be at the markets all weekend. That was my life. But so for me, having, you know, been in these spaces all my life, all these weekends, to have a space like My People's Market that's only for vendors of color was just like the most fulfilling and heartwarming thing. And it's, I love powwows, and we as a business will never give up vending at powwows, because even if our revenue isn't great, it means so much to us to be part of our community that is the meat, and that's what drives our my business. But My People's Market is really exciting because it's being put on by these bigger organizations like Prosper Portland and Travel Portland, and so you have this bigger platform to work off of. But it is just us. It's just vendors of color, and it's
people can come.
Anybody can come, of course. But it's just and that feeling is really, especially for here in Portland, where we just don't have those opportunities very often. It's really incredible to have all entertainers of communities of color, is something really meaningful to me and to my business. And it's been profitable. And so I love to see these things really working out. And I know that Tanya has a extensive history with organizing vending community here in Portland, the Native community here in Portland. I have an extensive history with just organizing in general, and I know that we can make this happen.
Different vision of the market than the dominant one in capitalism where you see in malls. Just in closing, what about the last Thursday in Alberta Street? There is a square. You've both been involved in developing that the last few years on, I think it's 21st and Alberta. Just in closing, say a little bit about what that square means to you as vendors and culturally and politically what it means to have that space.
So it's now being called the Res on Alberta.
And that's a term that gets taken up in a proud, defiant way.
Well, initially, I hated it because I was like, that's a chunk that the white guy carved out for us. But then I thinking about it, I was able to process it. And it was like, no, we're taking that back. And it's given more in reparation. And we're working with a fellow from the city. His name's Greg. And he's working so hard to make this space for us because he knows how horrible things have been historically for us. And I really appreciate the city for allowing this too. It's a really beautiful thing that they're doing, and trying to heal some of that and give us this opportunity not only to make things better for us, but also it's a marketing strategy that they see that will help us out and bring people to our area. Because it is a whole group of us, and there is a community and a culture that isn't necessarily to be found in other spaces.
And then the vulnerability of being an isolated vendor and being targeted is an issue that it sounds like you're trying to address as a community to support each other. And if something happens, you have others there.
Absolutely.
This Thursday is going to be super fun. We have over 7 vendors that are committed to being there, as well as 3 or 4 community resources that will have free face painting, free decolonized water, Farming Resources, organically grown company, has donated apples and bananas that we're giving away. We'll do crafting, basket weaving. We're doing Cherokee baskets like we did last month that people just got incredibly creative and made just beautiful. People started putting beads in the back, you know, just really made it their own, and it was amazing, and we're excited.
So it's a participatory, not that the passive consumer model.
Exactly. Hang out with us.
Please.
Get to know your vendors. We'll be 21st there. Alberta.
Okay. And if enough people show up, then we'll start having story time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing your stories and your work here on KBOO this morning on the Old Mole.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, this is Jan Hawken with Yuvia Magala Morello and Tanya Golden talking about the Native American Community Artist Village space at last Thursday. Join them this Thursday evening on Alberta Street.
Excellent. Thank you all. Also, wanted to remind folks that Nicole McCormick will be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. about the West Virginia teacher strike. That, I believe, is at the Portland Association of Teachers offices. Folks will have to go online to double check me on that. Coming up on KBOO at 10 a.m. is Locus Focus with Barbara Bernstein, author of Fallout, Disaster, Lies, and the Legacy of the Nuclear Age, Making Contact, Trump's Travel and Refugee Ban, Voices for the Animals, talks to members of the SAVE movement who are bearing witness to farmed animals on their way to the slaughterhouse. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thank you for tuning in this morning. We're back next Monday.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Onion Music Festival starting July 28th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space in Washougal, Washington. The Onion Music Festival features a three-day lineup of musicians, artists, installations, and vendors. Performers include the fabulous Downey Brothers, The Fur Coat, Night Heron, Adebisi, and many more. This is an 18 and over event with no dogs allowed. Again, that's the Onion Music Festival, July 28th and 29th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space, 30303 Northeast 10th Street in Washougal, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Happy birthday!
The Oregon Historical Society is featuring 50 years of KBOO.